Good afternoon, everyone. This is a rulemaking hearing held in accordance with the State Administrative Procedures Act, Section 244103, Colorado Revised Statutes. The date is May 5th, 2009. The time is 2:06 p.m. We're meeting in the Secretary of State's Blue Spruce Conference Room, 1700 Broadway, Denver, Colorado. My name is Bill Hobbs. I'm Deputy Secretary of State, and I'm conducting the rulemaking hearing on behalf of Secretary of State Bernie Busher. I'd like to maybe start with some other introductions. To my immediate left is Wayne Munster, who is the Acting Director of Elections and the Deputy Director of the Elections Division. To my immediate right is Hillary Rudy. To my far right is Andrea Geiger, both of the Secretary of State's office, both legal specialists with the Secretary of State's office. The purpose of the hearing today is to receive comments from the public on proposed rules, proposed amendments to the state election rules. These rules were first proposed in a notice of rulemaking that was issued on March 31st, 2009. And published in the Colorado Register on April 10th, 2009. The original version of the proposed rules has been modified slightly. The version that I'd like to work off of today is dated April 30th, 2009. Copies are on the table by the door. Minor changes to the original proposal. Just by way of background, I'd like to mention just some of the reasons for the proposed rules. There are a number of changes and new rules relating to different statuses of voters. There's some definitions added to Rule 1.1, defining different statuses of voters. And then there's an amendment to Rule 2.18 that deals with how different statuses of voters are treated. The basic purpose here is to try to provide some more clarity and some more consistency in how voters are treated under different circumstances. The primary theme here is to try to provide greater protection for voters, while at the same time ensuring that the state meets its obligations to under the National Voter Registration Act and the Help America Vote Act to maintain clean voter registration lists. There is also a proposed rule, a new Rule 50, that would establish an Elections Best Practices and Vision Commission. The Secretary is very interested in maintaining an ongoing review of elections technology and elections best practices. And I think this is primarily intended maybe to dovetail with the work of the Election Reform Commission, which had a very compressed time frame in which to look at the elections issues following the 2008 general election and prior to its required reporting date of March 1 of this year. And there's also a proposed rule amendment to Rule 2.10, which is to answer some questions that we get from county clerks from time to time as to how to treat voters who provide incomplete information under certain circumstances. So with that background, again, the primary purpose is to receive public comments today. We have received some written comments, and I will probably leave the rulemaking record open for a little while after today to receive additional public comments. I'm going to turn to the sign-up sheet, and I should have mentioned that if anybody wants to testify, please do sign up on one of the sign-up sheets on the table by the door. And when you testify, be sure to give your name and who you represent, if anyone. This is a formal rulemaking hearing. It is recorded, and it is also broadcast over the Internet. So with that, if that hopefully completes all my preliminaries, then I'll turn to the sign-up sheet. The first person I have signed up is Stephanie O'Malley. Welcome.
Good afternoon, Deputy Secretary Hobbs and members of the Hearing Board. I appreciate the opportunity. I am Stephanie O'Malley, the Denver County Clerk and Recorder, and I just had a few comments on the proposed rules that I'd like to share with the Board this afternoon. Let me first start by saying that Denver is appreciative of the spirit of the proposed rules. We certainly understand the basis and from which they come, and always willing to come in and chime in on what we believe to be very important subject matters. Specifically, I want to just kind of go down the rules as they are proposed with our comments. I'll start with proposed rule 1.1. With regards to the definitional sections there, I noticed that the definitions, they go beyond strictly defining terms. Each defined term, from my observation, includes a policy action statement that's attached to the definition itself, and we were just wondering why the policy action statements are included in the definitional portion of the proposed rule rather than being addressed more in traditional provisions of the rules that speak to policy. And I'd just like to give an example since we are over the Internet. The first definition, it says active status or active record means that there are no conditions or restrictions on the voter's eligibility. From my perspective, the definition stops there, but in the proposed rule, the language goes on to state active status voters' names will appear on the poll book, they will be sent a ballot in a mail ballot election, and they will be sent election notice mailings. Each of the defined terms in the proposed rule, including definitions A, B, C, D, E, F, G, and H, from our perspective, include these policy statements. I just wanted to bring that to your attention.
Thank you. And I might add, as a former legislative drafter, we were always taught limit your definitions to definitions and put the substantive provisions in other sections. But, you know, I think there were probably also just some mechanical reasons why it was done this way, but I think the point is well taken. So.
Thank you. One additional observation that I have related to the definitions is the difference in the extent to which direction is given in some but not in others. And I'll give you an example. Under definition A of active status or active record, the definition as proposed is succinct in detailing that a voter in a mail ballot election will be sent a ballot and will be sent election notice mailings. If you contrast that with definition H, where it says inactive undeliverable ballot status, the definition is silent on the subject of whether the voter will be sent a ballot. The very definition that presumably is designed to address the treatment of undeliverable ballot status voters, it fails to speak to ballot delivery, and as proposed, it only addresses the treatment of the election notice mailings. So I'm just trying to understand why, like in A, it's very succinct as to, you know, who will be sent election notice mailings. And then in H, the definition is silent on sending mail ballots when that portion of the definition speaks specifically to inactive undeliverable ballot status. So from my perspective, some disparate treatment again in just defining those terms and what happens with regards to them. Okay. Moving down, the proposed definition in G, where it says inactive return mail status or inactive undeliverable status, I would propose that you either strike the language that says or inactive undeliverable status, or if that language is maintained, to amend A under proposed rule 2.18.3. I'll let you get there if you need to.
Or what was that last reference?
2.18.3, letter A there. Currently, the language reads, whose records have been marked, quote, inactive, hyphen, returned mail, end quote, quote, inactive, slash, NCOA, end quote, or, quote, inactive, hyphen, undeliverable ballot. I would suggest that you make these two definitions equal in their presentation, or strike the language that is in G, because one has it and the other one doesn't. Okay? So either put it in both or take it out of the one. Do you understand what I'm...
I think so.
Okay. All righty. Focusing on proposed rule 2.18.2, we were just curious as to whether there's a legitimate reason why the proposed comparison is limited only to voters marked inactive, failed to vote. We're wondering why the action proposed in the rule wouldn't extend to compare the records of all voters with the NCOA database. Why is it limited just inactive, failed to vote status voters? It is our belief and opinion from Denver that if you compared the entire voter list, that there wouldn't be a need for us to send ballots to bad addresses. The list would be cleaner. We certainly would save money on postage, and there would be fewer ballots out there, you know, potentially set for some ill consumption by folks. Just curious as to why the action there was limited to inactive failed to vote voters, higher voter list to keep it going. And then lastly, my comment is that regarding proposed rule 2.18.3, the proposed language fails to speak to whether the cancellations can be treated by a systematic batch process or whether each of these records have to be touched individually. If there's no opportunity for a county like myself and the larger ones or all of the counties to do systematic batch processes, then, you know, for Denver, we're talking upwards of tens of thousands of records that will have to individually be touched to make cancellation determinations. And I would suggest that, you know, this, of course, leads to other considerations like personnel, cost that's associated with having to have individuals perform this work on individuals rather than being able to conduct this function by batch functions. But the rule is silent on that, doesn't say it. That's all I have.
Okay.
Thank you. I do want to provide an opportunity for
folks from the office to ask questions, because I'm depending on them to actually help digest the comments that we get. Any questions?
Yes, sir. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Stephanie.
Harvey Branscombe.
Deputy Secretary of the Office, thank you very much. Harvey Branscombe. I'm a member of the Eagle County Canvas Board. I noted the Eagle County Clerk is actually here, which is makes two of us coming from a very long distance to be at this hearing. I wanted to basically address the best practices and vision commission enabling portion of the language that's being proposed. I would, however, caution that I come from a county where addresses are very confused, and there are a great many people who have residential addresses who are not deliverable by mail, and often the post office is actually making decisions autonomously about whether or not to deliver something into a post box or not, to a residential address or not. Sometimes they are actually, it'll be difficult for the law to depend on the post office to consistently handle the mail, it seems to me, and that may affect the actual result, voter by voter, of these rules as they have been stated here. But it's such a complicated situation. There are entire towns that don't have delivery to residential addresses in Eagle County, and I think it's something that people who live here in the metro area need to think about clearly. It's not so obvious what will happen to a mailing that's sent to an address in Eagle County. But I wanted to talk about basically what amounts to the best practices for the best practices and vision commission, because that seems to be what this hearing will be about. It's important to us, the members of the public who are not election officials and who are not vendors and who are not county clerks, to understand how this commission will incorporate us and how it will benefit us. And in the first part of that would be to understand what the role of this commission will be, and I would like to propose several possible roles that I've already heard mentioned to me. One of them is as an extension of the Election Reform Commission. And the Election Reform Commission actually did recommend to extend itself in some form, although not in a very specific way, apparently. The Election Reform Commission, however, we are gradually learning, really didn't function in the role of accepting public input and trying to understand what might be wrong with election practice and try to create a list of improvements to election practice. It appears to have operated under a kind of externally imposed agenda of some kind, and we can recognize that at least in the respect to the governor's legal office saying that they had started work on the bills that were produced by the Election Reform Commission even before the Election Reform Commission was started. So I wanted to make sure that the Best Practices and Vision Commission didn't suffer from that same kind of a problem, where there is perhaps a hidden or an unstated agenda behind the commission. And or if it is to do that, then I would like to make sure that the agenda is well stated, so that those of us who might attempt to participate can understand what the result of our participation is likely to be. I've heard that the Best Practices and Vision Commission could be an input mechanism for the public, and whereas, by the way, the public includes, in my mind, a wide variety of individuals, including vendors and so forth, who take advantage of public input opportunities. So I'm not defining the public as only the people who have no other possible explanation for a reason to be testifying. But that for rulemaking is one whole area where the Best Practices Commission might be applying its effort. And then there's the other area, which is lawmaking. We've heard it said, well, I think the Election Reform Commission recommended that the Secretary of State should consider revisions to Title I rather than the legislature doing it. And if that's the case, then I think that ought to be stated. We ought to understand perhaps there are going to be two different times in which these two different kinds of topics will be approached. But at least I'd like it to be made clear that this commission would be addressing process of rulemaking or rules for potential rulemaking, and also possible changes in statute. I'm interested in having better defined what the role of the various different possible individual or roles that would be involved in the commission, the election officials, the vendors, academics, election quality activists, possible roles that would be involved, to understand what the power balance might be. If we would probably be able to look at a final list of members who are on this commission and understand, as we did when we looked at the Election Reform Commission, that either this is predominantly people who are responsible for the election, or it's predominantly not people who are. And I think that ought to be, it's not clear in the rules as they have been proposed so far. As a matter of fact, there is a pretty big difference between the rules proposed for this commission and the one for the SCORE commission, which is already in Rule 49.4, I guess. That one actually calls for a decision-making process about how the commission will operate. And I would like to see some better definition for this commission how it will make decisions, because if I were to be a member on that commission, I would like to understand what influence I personally would have in respect to the other members on the commission, what the mode of interaction would be, whether or not it would be possible for me from the western part of Colorado to participate without driving to Denver, and so forth. There are elements like that that are actually written into the rule already for the other commission, the SCORE commission. And I'd like to see some better specificity like that. I'd like to know how the how to avoid the expertise available to the commission being limited to the expertise that's contained by its members. That means I think it would be good to understand how the commission would be able to access external expertise. Perhaps there should be a budgetary affordance for obtaining expertise from people who would, who might need to be paid in order to testify. That hasn't been incorporated in the rule. I'd like to understand how, I'd like to state, first of all, my preference that this commission would not work like a committee over at the legislature to the extent that it would depend on factual statements of fact and arguments of reason rather than the political process that we see over at the legislature. I think there's a huge benefit to be had from working here where the administrative nature of this department should be able to remove the political influence substantially from these discussions. And when I say political, I don't necessarily mean between Republicans or Democrats or Greens or so, but between the different, we see some polarization between those who are like myself, members of the public who are participating on canvas boards and monitoring election quality, and those who are actually manifesting the election quality as election officials. So there is a political a dichotomy there almost. And we'd like to understand that we're surpassing that political level of misunderstanding and getting to facts and rationality, because that's what's really needed to improve Colorado election law and election rule. I'd like to know how specific the commission will be to Colorado. We could actually bring in experts from the outside who know generally about election procedure, law, rules in states generically or other states specifically, but it's important that this commission address itself to Colorado-specific issues, and it's important that the knowledge that's being brought to bear actually has a direct understanding of Colorado statute and existing Colorado rules. But on the other hand, it's very important for the expertise to have access to experience that's beyond what we have in Colorado. And so this is there's a balance that needs to be made there. And it's important not to just go to one end of that spectrum or the other. We want to have the expertise of clerks who are actually working with the existing equipment, but if we're going to be looking at best practices, then we need to have knowledge from expertise that comes from other vendors' equipment, possible future vendors' equipment, other ways of doing audits, et cetera, all of these things we don't have experience about directly in Colorado. We need to have that experience brought in somehow. I'm concerned that we be specific and not too generic. I know that the legislature has been telling us for the last couple of weeks in various ways that they don't want to be very specific in statute, and the Secretary of State's job is to get very specific. And so, of course, I think that's almost a no-brainer, but I just wanted to mention it for completeness, hoping that the influence over this commission of the County Clerks Association will not be too great, as opposed to the influence of specific knowledgeable clerks. And I know that may be a very strange thing to say, but the SCORE Commission actually has a role for the Colorado County Clerks Association, and I would not like to see that same kind of the rule creating this commission actually refer to that. I know it doesn't at the moment, so I'm not actually calling out a specific problem. I'm a warning about the fact that I think the Colorado County Clerks Association is neither monolithic nor does it necessarily represent the kind of knowledge or influence that would best benefit the best practices and vision commission. in going forward, and that's only coming from my past experience. So it's more of a that's a description of my own experience with the association. I'm concerned to make sure that we have a freedom from bias in the agenda of the commission, and that would be protected if we had a mode of operation that allowed for a good extent of openness and sufficient time for and openness to agenda items coming in from the outside, but from a variety of unlimited potential sources, including the public or vendors or so. It's important we have enough time. Two meetings per year as called for seems strangely low, and I'm going to exemplify that in a moment by just listing a number of topics I think ought to be addressed by the Best Practices and Vision Commission. But the number two, even compared to the SCORE Commission is intended to meet at least four per year, and I'm expecting that in order to be useful, this commission will have to meet more than that, perhaps not physically, but somehow meet more often than twice per year. I want to make sure that questions get asked and answered. And this is a two-way thing, that questions should be asked from the commission to the public. For example, what is your vision of the best election system? And there are members of the public who will have such visions. Maybe they're holistic or maybe they're component-oriented, but that question was never asked by the Election Reform Commission, and I think it should have been. It was the first question I expected to be asked, and it's one I expect this commission to ask. Likewise, if the public has questions for the commission, I would hope that the commission would have a way of answering the public. So we need a clear statement of the operating procedures for the Best Practices and Vision Commission, and if it's not in rule, then it needs to be the first order of business of the commission, but the rule should call for that. Well, then I'd like to, if you don't mind, I'd like to mention some topic areas that I think would be appropriate. Is that appropriate for this testimony now?
Sure, and I think it might also relate to further defining the scope in the rule itself, I mean, which is one of the things that you've asked for, so... I think it would be helpful to know some of the items that you think would be appropriate.
Right. So just going to list it. I actually have to say that my list is probably short, although it's going to seem long. And I'll go over it pretty quickly. I know for sure that I haven't covered the agreement.
You're starting to worry me now.
I just want to put you on. By the way, I'm glad to see so many friendly faces out here. And This is by far the most constructive public hearing on rulemaking that I've been at, has the best potential for a constructive outcome of the other ones that I've been at. I'm really glad that it's happening, and I want to thank the Secretary of State's office for doing that. I can't thank you for putting it on this day, because today is election day in Pitkin County, and it's a major election going on in my vicinity. It's also the day before, or could have been the last day of the legislative session, and the election bills likely being discussed in the Senate right now, this very moment, and I was torn on where to go today, and this isn't the first such public testimony, opportunity for public testimony that's happened on a day that was inconvenient. It's been scheduled on the day before election day in the past, and I think the Secretary of State's office knows well enough the schedule of these events that people interested in this topic will want to be at to know not to schedule a meeting for to this day. So here are the topics, starting from the top, perhaps the most important topic. What are the principles that need to be in election law? What constitutes a good election? There are very few words in the statute that actually refer to the quality of the election, what it consists of.
Let me ask for clarification, because I wanted to know the kinds of ideas, the things that you thought the commission ought to address, but when you said you wanted to list the principles of a good election, I'm wondering if those things would be more appropriate for the commission itself once it's established.
And I wasn't actually going to give you the actual principles. I am only posing the question,
Okay.
What are the principles?
Okay, I misunderstood.
What are the principles is the... Okay.
Gotcha.
What I imagine to be the agenda of the best practices.
I thought you were going to answer that question as well.
No, I'm actually not going to answer any of those these questions I'm about to ask. Sorry. How to describe the principles suitable for law? How to measure our adherence to the principles? That's a very key piece. And that's what turns something that's qualitative into quantitative. And that's what I mean by dealing with factuality rather than politics, is creating rules where there's a specific procedure or a test which allows you to understand whether you have a transparent XYZ or do you have an accessible XYZ. If it passed this test, then you do, and otherwise you don't. That's the level of specificity that belongs in rule, but the principle should be in law. So how do we then conform existing law to these principles, and how do we conform our existing rules to them to make a transition process from where we are now to a consistent body of law and body of rule and body of practices that actually conform to these principles? Second major topic area, how to achieve transparency of the process. This breaks down into two parts, the lawmaking process, and we are gaining great experience understanding how what lack of transparency in the lawmaking process means and how we have to try to figure out when the public hearings are going to be over at the legislature, and we don't know from hour to hour when they'll actually happen. I know you experience the same uncertainty, so I know you are aware of those problems, but for the members of the public who aren't experts at tracking, this becomes impossible to actually participate in the legislative process. So this would be an area where I would expect law preferably would change to make the legislative process more transparent when it comes to discussing elections. And likewise, the rulemaking process, of which we are now experiencing an example. So it's important in this process that, I guess I will answer this particular one because it's so relevant to where we are right now. The documents submitted to public hearings like this one, I think, ought to be made public. And I understand, I was told a couple of days ago in your presence, I think, that we could use open records requests to obtain those documents, and it hadn't occurred to me that I would be told it would be standard procedure to do that, and that we are being encouraged to issue open records requests in order to get the public documents that are provided at one of these hearings. I think that ought to be a standard process where the documents are available, and not an exceptional one. And of course, the question of who can initiate this rulemaking process is an important one, and there's a rule that states that there are only six or seven kinds of entities that can initiate this process, and they seem to exclude a great many of the people in this room. Not all. Some of them actually do apply, but for many of us in this room, it doesn't apply. Third major area, how do we know the quality of the election or of the result of the election? I realize that the audit becomes part of this, and there is probably going to be an effort to improve our audit, and I'm all in favor of that. But there are other areas that are involved here besides audit, the collecting and reporting of election results, the designing and the collecting and reporting of the tests and the test results, and the certification, the acceptance test, hardware test, LAT audit, the need for the independence of these tests from the actual election practice. So this is a whole area that is a kind of a big bullet point, one of the major areas that ought to be addressed by a best when looking for best practices in election law. And then to just subdivide those down a little bit with a little more specificity, the certification best practices, I'm concerned that we don't have certification tests that actually match election scale. And I think that the best practices ought to consider the possibility of running election scale tests and election context tests, which means ones that are really matching the characteristics of a real election, if not an actual real election. And I think both are possible. There's also the question of the transparency of those tests. And I know I've mentioned that at this microphone before, but I think everybody in the room, including you, know that we're concerned about the accessibility to the actual, this, not just the specifications of the tests, but the actual outcome of the tests in order to be able to understand how specific they are, how relevant they are, and how meaningful they are. And then finally, the sharing of our tests with other interested parties, just as the law perhaps about to be passed is calling for others to share their outcome of their tests with us. So that ties all together. Colorado's tests ought to be able to be used by other states if our documentation is good enough. And I've had conversations with you about the level of quality of the documentation of the tests in order to make them useful. I think that's an important topic for the Best Practices Commission. But then there's the control over the election on a statewide and a kind of general level basis. Who should have that control? And how much of it? Because there's a reason to say that the election really belongs to the citizens, and the citizens essentially ought to be managing their own election in order to be able to successfully change their government. And if the government has too much influence over the election, then the citizens may not be able to peaceably overturn their government and may be forced to resort to something much less desirable. And so it's very, very important that the citizens have the practical opportunity to change their government without improper impediments that might be applied by government decisions. So we need to prevent partisan effects when the parties run balanced in the roles that are governing the election. For example, the canvas board, where we have canvas boards often of three people, and they're almost very, very likely to be two of one party and one of another party. And we have, of course, designated election officials are partisan, and our Secretary of State is technically a partisan office holder. So these are questions that ought to be brought up. I think there was actually a House joint resolution to address the question of whether the statewide management of elections should be done by a partisan office or not. But that proposal was withdrawn, apparently, so that particular conversation will not take place there. Perhaps it could take place here. Just looking at it from another perspective, from the perspective of the election official, how to make them independent of potential accusations of partisan influence. I know our previous Secretary of State received those kinds of accusations, and really there should be the statute and rules should be set up to protect those individuals from unnecessary or improper or excessive accusations of influence, and they shouldn't be given the opportunity to make decisions that are partisan affecting decisions, or at least a minimum of those.
And so, Harvey, let me, and I'm sorry to keep interrupting you on this side. I know it's hard to draw the line between a topic like control over elections and then advocating an outcome, which you're kind of doing both, and I know it's kind of hard to separate that, but I think in the interest of time, because other people want to testify as well,
I won't go on much longer. There's the test, the practices involved in the logic and accuracy testing and hardware testing. Hardware testing is almost insignificant now, but it could be much enhanced and would greatly increase the credibility of the election, and probably without losing much time. So currently we're just using power-up tests in equipment, and I think we could do a lot better in terms of using a standard set of ballots or records of the vote to actually test all of the hardware before an election in order to avoid trying to depend on the logic and accuracy test to do that function. I know that there's it's not clear which test is trying to perform which protection, but it could be made much more clear. And that would make things much more effective and efficient. Some kind of flexibility for follow-up on discrepancies that are discovered in testing. I've had experiences where the Secretary of State's informed us that we can't go beyond 25 ballots in testing, even though there might have been an indication that we should, and that needs to be addressed in rule. And then I'm not actually going to spend a lot of time talking about the audit. We did prepare an amendment with a list of considerations for better practice in audit, and that document stands on its own. I think it's already in your hands. Likewise, the recount. So the recount in law and rule has real defects, I think, and that's going to involve a discussion of what manual count means and the accuracy of a manual count versus the accuracy of a machine count, And it looks like we're going to have to address that in Colorado because there's no general consensus that the accuracy of the election is based on a manual count. And I think that's going to turn out to be a really big issue, and it's got to be addressed. Ballot design, none of the above, the potential benefit of having none of the above on the ballot. The coordination of electronic and paper ballot design and the great difficulties that election officials go through to try to really design two different ballots, even though the software was ostensibly set up to handle both. That's an area we need to remember that if we're talking about law, that we should be thinking about possible revisions in what the vendors provide to us that could be provided 5 or 10 years from now and would be included in Certification Rule 45 and guide the development of software in the future. And I would say that even though there are those who say Colorado is too small to affect the vendors' decisions, I don't think so. I think we are enough ahead at enough of a melting pot of different technologies and different voting methods that other states are looking at us, and we need to be smart. And that's what I'm hoping will come out of this Best Practices and Vision Commission, is that kind of smartness to look not only at the next election, but the 1-5 elections down the road. Election data reporting, the posting and precincts, the time of reporting of the elections, very important topics for possible improvement in best practices. And I could have gone on, but I actually won't. I will stop now because those, I think, are really key points. But the story behind that is it's a really long list, and I'm not sure that of the ones I just mentioned that even a fraction of them were discussed at the Election Reform Commission. So a great many topics left undiscussed, and we are prepared to discuss them. So
okay. Thank you, Harvey. I appreciate it. Any questions?
No, sir.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mary Everly.
Welcome.
Thank you, Chair Hobbs, and members of the chair. Is this on? Okay. Anyway, thank you very much. Mary Eberle Boulder, and I'm representing Coloradans for Voting Integrity and myself. And I also want to thank Harvey for giving you such a nice list. We feel there are many topics. I've provided written testimony from our board, and I don't know, would it be appropriate because of people listening to read this? It's not terribly long. What is the appropriate procedure?
Is that the page and a half?
Yes. Or maybe a page when you take off the signature.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, if you want to summarize it, maybe that would be best.
Okay.
I have read it, and I appreciate it. I appreciate the input.
Well, we hope that the people who will be on, we're focusing on the rules as they've been presented so far. And we notice that there's sort of a general category for voting advocacy groups. And we'd suggest that they be Colorado-based. There are three groups that we're particularly familiar with, Colorado Voter Group, Democracy Technology Foundation, and then, of course, Coloradans for Voting Integrity. And everybody in these groups has looked in great depth for a long period of time about election processes, procedures, and equipment as these things affect Colorado elections. And these are all citizen-based groups. They're not generally people who have been elected to an office or hold a particular position in a party or something of that nature. We want to have members of this commission to be really forward-looking people who are focused on how future elections can be really good. And we have looked at the membership of the SCORE Advisory Board, the way that that membership list is set up. And we noticed that there's a lot of diversity requested of the members in terms of what geographic part of Colorado they represent, or whether they're in a large or a small county, what voting vendor their county uses, so that different vendors, so clerks using different vendors would be part of the SCORE system oversight, and other sorts of diversity. And we're really hoping that that type of rule would be part of the best practices and vision commission rule, so that the clerks that are involved are not focused from just one area or just one party or whatever. So we'd like similar language that way. We like the operational rules that are present in the SCORE Advisory Board listing, and we'd like those to be adopted. We really encourage you to go for transparency in every way, and one way would be to make the records of the meetings accessible over the internet. And of course, transcription is really nice because you can do searches and so forth, but audio files would be good. And if audio files were used, we encourage that members identify themselves as they're putting forth their arguments or having a discussion, so that people listening later on can know who that was. And then this is sort of a general idea. It's not something maybe that needs to be in a rule. It's more, but perhaps it should be. I don't know. We just suggest a discussion-oriented framework or format, or at least for part of the way the commission operates, so that there isn't the restriction of the formal testimony format that the legislative committees use. We think that a discussion-oriented format would lead to better interactions between members of the commission, and you know, chances for intellectual growth, maybe, or you know, things that might cause difficulties down the road could perhaps be resolved right at the spot. So anyway, I think facilitation by, I'm not certain, Deputy Secretary Hobbs, would you be chairing this, or would the secretary, we
don't know
the structure quite yet. But in any case, somebody will be the chair, and that person could facilitate discussion so that nobody is left out of the conversation. That would be good. And we just so much appreciate Secretary of State Buescher's decision to formulate this commission, and we really appreciate the opportunity to participate here as you think about the rules. Thank you very much.
Okay.
And answer any questions.
Thank you, Mary. Questions? Thank you very much. Jenny Flanagan. Hi.
Good afternoon. My name is Jenny Flanagan. I'm the Executive Director of Colorado Commons House, and we work for open, honest, and accountable government and to increase public participation in the political process, and have been working on voting issues. Obviously, I've been the Executive Director since 2004, and that's been one of my primary jobs. My comments will be limited today to the inactive fail to vote issue and the election, the commission, excuse me. I'll start by saying I think the clerk and recorder from Denver, Stephanie O'Malley, raised some interesting questions, so I'm very interested to see the outcome of the issues that she raised, and hope that some of those questions will be addressed if there's a revision or redraft. On the issue of inactive fail to vote, I think most Coloradans now know that this has been a long-time problem in our state. It's an issue that has been addressed by the legislature, albeit, in our opinion, inadequately, but there has been a lot of legislative debate, and certainly among the folks in this room who work on election issues, it's been an ongoing conversation. Our concerns are that the current law moves voters to inactive fail to vote too quickly, that the mere failure to vote in one general election puts them on a pathway toward cancellation. One of the bigger impacts that we've seen of this law is that voters who in counties that choose to do a vote by mail election, that inactive fail to vote status would cause them not to receive a ballot. And that was one of the issues that Clerk O'Malley raised, which isn't not addressed in that current definition as to whether or not those voters would in fact receive a ballot in their inactive fail to vote status. So I'm curious if the board can tell me what the intention there is, if those voters would be eligible to receive ballots. I'll also say that we're very glad to see this issue being addressed, because we do believe that this rulemaking leads us toward improvement. I guess one of our concerns is whether or not a rulemaking is the most effective resolution of this issue, or if we need a statutory change. So I think that's another question that I have for the board, as to whether or not voters will truly be afforded the protection that's intended here, in terms of whether or not they would end up down that path of cancellation, whether or not the rule is in contradiction to the current statute, which sets them down that path. So just curious about the thinking there, and whether or not the Secretary's office has thought about a statutory fix as well.
Jenny, perhaps I shouldn't interrupt at this point, but your concern is that the proposed rules may be in conflict with state statute?
That's correct.
And could you just elaborate a little bit?
Well, as I understand it, it's unclear to me whether or not they are. So the current law says that if you're made inactive, fail to vote, or if you're made inactive for failure to vote in one general election, you receive notice and then subsequently miss two general elections after that fact, then you could be canceled from the voter registration list. This rule says that those voters would be checked against the change of address, and maybe that would become the trigger. I guess that's a clarification, rather than we would still also set them down that path of cancellation.
I think, and I'm not sure I'm following, but I think probably the intent was to actually be a little more restrictive than a broad reading of current law provides, that there would have to be something more than simple failure to vote for two general elections and failure to respond to notices.
Right, and I think we would support we support that concept. I guess my question is, and you know, you obviously have done more of that research, whether or not the statute, has currently been read much more broadly. Obviously, I mean, the practice has been to set those folks down cancellation lane and then, in fact, cancel them. So this rulemaking would change the current practice, and we just want to make sure that that protection would be as effective as it's intended to be here in the proposed rule. And I know that we have had many conversations over the years of the rulemaking versus statutory changes, and in this instance, I would argue that a statutory change would be the most effective to reach resolution. In fact, we have argued, that voters should not be set down this sort of path of cancellation at all for the mere failure to vote. So the current requirement that voters be made inactive for failure to miss one general election, again, it is too aggressive, and we would argue that they should never be moved to inactive just for failure to vote, that there would need to be another trigger, as you suggest, or as Clerk O'Malley raised, by doing a check against the change of address database. If we did decide that we needed to maintain a failure to vote inactive status, we would suggest at least two general elections rather than the current one. We've seen this on a number of instances, talking with the many groups that we work with, that voters don't always engage in non-presidential elections. And this current rule, if there's a non-presidential election, they would still be set down this path. So again, penalizing these voters for the mere failure to vote, we think is too aggressive. And while we're glad to see this rulemaking, hope for continued conversation to have a stronger change in the future.
And the penalizing the voters, are you referring to they're not getting a ballot in a mail ballot election? I mean, they're not being canceled. Their eligibility is not being canceled, but
in the first instance, when they're initially made inactive, no, they're not being canceled, but their status does change in terms of the mail ballot. The legislature addressed this sort of inadequately, that I think in the 2009 election, voters would be getting mail ballots, but I don't believe that it extends beyond that. So I think that issue is still out there as to whether or not inactive fail to vote get ballots. So we think there is a detrimental harm there. But broadly speaking, I think voters are confused about this issue. And when they look up their voter status, whether they're talking to their county clerks or to the secretary's office or our organization, we absolutely hear from voters, what does it mean to be inactive? What has happened to my record? So it does create sort of a unnecessary confusion, in our opinion, about what a voter's status is. And again, it may not be detrimental and their votes may still be counted. From our perspective, we want to make sure that the voting process is as accessible as possible for all voters. And again, the mere failure to vote shouldn't be something that would cause a voter to question their eligibility if it's not necessary. And in our opinion, missing one general election is not something that would trigger that kind of confusion for the voter.
Thank you.
On the commission, we're also very glad to see a commission like this being created. And my one point on this is we're also glad to see that voting advocates are included on sort of the list of who will be included. And we just want to say that we hope that those groups will have a meaningful role as part of this commission. And particularly want to see groups that have been working closely on election issues in the state and represent traditionally disenfranchised groups in our state, including voters with disabilities, minority voters, low-income voters, that we've seen be impacted by various changes to our election law, whether it's the move to vote centers or vote by mail, the loss of the polling place. Various groups that work on these voting issues, I think, would bring a good perspective for the commission going forward. Thank you very much for the opportunity.
Thank you. Questions? Okay. Thank you, Jenny. Carol Tone, did you want to testify? Anybody else? Come forward. I don't think I have you on the sign-up sheet, but if you'll give your name and who you represent.
I wasn't quite sure where I'd get to. I'm Neil McBurnett, Boulder, Colorado. And, thank you for having this hearing today. I'm glad to see a good array of folks in attendance. I'm a computer security consultant and a contributor to the principles and best practices for post-election audits that was put together by a national group of experts in the last year, in preparation for the 2008 election. I've been working on improving election procedures since about 2002 as an election judge, an auditor, a poll worker, worked on legislation, and meet with auditing folks on a regular basis about twice a week, folks from around the states that are trying to improve election practices in general and election audits. And I've worked on standards when I was at Bell Laboratories on internet networking standards. I put together with Boulder, Colorado, some software called Election Audits that tries to take those best practices and bring them to the table of clerks who otherwise don't know all the ins and outs of the statistics and the random numbers and their things. And I think the main message that I would have for you today, speaking in particular to the best practices panel mission, is the need for more expertise in the growing range of areas in which expertise is needed for election administration. I think we all know how much over the last decade in particular practice of elections has changed with more electronic voting machines, more reliance on tabulation software, with discussions of internet voting, and implementation of it in some circumstances. I think we're moving from a world in which people kind of thought they knew how elections would work and what the risks were, what was necessary to enfranchise people, to a world in which range of issues that can come up gets more and more complex. And so I'd urge you to consider more representation, not only by clerks and election administrators who absolutely have on-the-ground experience with the equipment that we've got today, but also with people who not only understand computer security, which is critical with all of the different computerized parts of the election process, but also as we continue to talk about internet voting, computer network security, which encompasses a whole nother range of risks and issues. What is happening on the computer out there that's being used to do this voting? Computer scientists have wrestled with this, and I'm a computer scientist, have wrestled with this for decades. It's one of the very thorniest issues around, especially when you consider the anonymity requirements voting. So I think it's critical as you vision and as you establish best practices for anything that would even consider that and to deal with what has been, what is likely to be implemented, unfortunately. I think having more expertise in that area is very, very important. Another aspect that we're only every year increasing our appreciation for how important it is auditing. NIST has a National Institute of Standards and Technology. I help run a conference with them in Washington, D.C. each year. And they came to the conclusion that software independence is a critical aspect of election integrity. So, I find it interesting. Some people, I know their eyes glaze over, but appreciation for how to do proper sampling theory, for how to properly, transparently throw dice, get random numbers in there. There's just a lot of very interesting aspects of that, that there's now a body of expertise in. We've got people from other states that are willing to help with that. Being able to funnel that information into this commission, I think, is critical. Yes, I'll just close with that in summary again. We remember years and years ago, decades ago, when email came to the, what wasn't even called the internet then. People just wanted to get it out there, get it working, have people exchange messages. And they kind of understood the groundwork, and that was, well, there's only a couple of big computers on any campus, and there's careful people taking care of how those were administered, and you can kind of trust the system because they all had accounts and you know how it works. You don't have to worry about, email is just kind of sending a message back and forth. What we've learned, as everyone in the room, I'm sure, is experienced with the flood of spamming and phishing attacks where people try to get your bank account numbers and so on, it would have been helpful to pay a whole lot more attention early on to the intricacies of how computer security and quality assurance and auditing and all those things take place, and they're not easy topics. So I hope that you appoint folks to the commission and actually require that folks be appointed to the commission, have that kind of expertise, have also experience with
Thank you, Neil. And I think, you know, if 1335 does pass, the Secretary of State's office is going to need a lot of help on defining an audit process. So.
And I think there's an enormous opportunity for Colorado to provide an example for the rest of the country how to do that if we get the right coalition together to do that.
Thank you. Neil, and if you would, sign in on the sign-up sheet on the table. Thank you. Is there anybody else who would like to testify? Faith?
Good afternoon. Thank you. Faith Gross, representing the Legal Center for People with Disabilities and Older People. And I did not sign up, but will when I'm finished testifying.
Okay, thank you.
I'm going to be very, very brief. I just want to agree with Jenny Flanagan's comment that the voting advocacy organizations on this new commission should certainly include historically disenfranchised groups, and specifically, from my perspective, a representative of the disability community.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Faith. Okay. Anyone else? Margaret? Okay.
My name is Margaret Johansson. I'm from Boulder, Colorado, and with Coloradans for Voting Integrity. And Neil kind of started getting at what I wanted to emphasize, but I think with all these new systems that are kind of introduced without a lot of testing ahead of time, it's really important to back off a little bit and make use of the talents of our universities, and particularly if you can get them to do research for free. But a lot of, I think, from my watching this issue for a number of years, there's a lot of information, quote unquote, that's actually maybe motivated by self-interest, not objective reality. And I think it's really important for the system and the democracy of the system that we start gathering sort of system-like information of an objective sort by independent, reputable, trusted sources. And, you know, you've got a lot of universities around here. I'm not sure how many people are experts, but they could, they're on salary. If there's some way they could get, you know, do research that wouldn't cost you too much, or you could put out, if you have a question, maybe put it out to some of the research organizations or organizations that do research on these topics. Some of that stuff started coming out, but I think that's really important.
Okay. Thank you, Margaret. And if you would sign in on the sign-up sheet also, I'd be grateful. Is there anybody else who would like to testify? Seeing none, then I'll go ahead and close the hearing, but I would like to keep the record open until the close of business this Friday, the 8th, and encourage further comments from either people that are present or people who may be listening. And I'd also like to encourage if anyone has specific language that they would like to recommend by way of improvements to the proposed rules, I would be grateful for that also. So please, if you have whatever comments or language you might be able to provide us by the close of business this Friday, and I would suggest directing them to Andrea Geiger, andrea.geiger, G-Y-G-E-R, at sos.state.co.us. So thank you for coming, and thank you for your comments. The time is 3:14 p.m. We're adjourned. Thanks.